required work for every writer. Here, here you are in Kingston. You've got X amount of patois and this amount of corruption and this amount of grace and beauty. Write a story.
Thank you very much.
But you have really, this is just a great collection. And you're going to celebrate it, I see, right?
At, on Thursday at Miss Lily's.
At Miss Lily's, no less. Kingston Noir celebration. It's to celebrate the 50th year of Jamaica's independence. And you get what? They're giving out red stripes? Or is that you buy them yourself and you just go and you listen to you do a dramatic reading? Are you going to read from your own story?
Yeah, I'm going to read. And my good friend David Pilgrim, who's a musician, will accompany me on bass and acoustic guitar. And David and I have worked together like this before. We did How to Beat a Child the Right and Proper Way, the Public Theater in 2007.
Uh-huh.
And also the photographer, Varun Baker, who shot the cover, will be there well to talk about it. So it's going to be a great, it's going to be a fun time.
Fun.
Good music. The vibe at Miss Lily's is always great. And you know what? I think, you know, next month Jamaica will officially turn 50. There'll be so many celebrations. I think it'd be good to get out ahead of those celebrations and come to Miss Lily's on Thursday.
And Miss Lily's is at 132 West Houston Street.
Right.
It's been, it's getting quite a lot of attention, isn't it?
It's an Irish place, you know.
It is an Irish place. And closest you can get to the source in, I think, Manhattan anyway. I don't know. There's a lot of
you know. In fact, you know, when you're in Miss Lily's, you're basically in Kingston, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And when you walk out the door, you ain't.
Right, there you go.
I want to thank you so much. And I hope, will you join us in person here when you're back in New York City?
I would love to.
We love having you, you know.
All right.
Kingston Noir is edited by Colin Channer. It's one of the newest of the Noir series. It is the newest of Akashic Books' Noir series. This is Kingston Noir. And I must say, you must be overjoyed to be working with these people. Johnny Temple seems to be one of the really most original and wonderful new publishers, just working against...
Absolutely. I mean, Akashic is hands down one of the top three publishers in America, simply put. I mean, and Johnny and Johanna and Ibrahim and the whole staff there, I mean, they're just fantastic. And then, you know what? They do great work and they make it look easy.
Yeah. Well, you've made it look easy, too, I must say. This is just one of the most readable. Just run right through it. You, get on your motorcycle and read this book.
All right.
Thank you, Colin Channer. Pleasure.
Be at Miss Lily's on Thursday.
Yeah, be at Miss Lily's at Thursday at 7.
Yes, at 7.
Okay. See you then. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ah, look who is here again.
We are back.
Bonjour!
It's the French couple.
We are not the French couple.
We are the couple from France.
Well, I bet you know the answer. Where does consciousness go when we die?
Where does consciousness come from?
Consciousness was created by the Big Bang.
So the Higgs boson particle, which caused the Big Bang, also caused consciousness.
They are calling it the God particle.
It was supposed to be the goddamned particle.
Because it was so goddamned hard to find.
But they found it.
In Geneva, Switzerland.
So nice that Monsieur Higgs is still alive to enjoy the moment.
Ah, Monsieur Higgs. Hey to him. I hope he's around when they finish building the artificial brain that will prove that it's the brain that creates the soul.
I know, because a network of neurons in the brain develops self-awareness.
Dr. Higgs has achieved the height of enjoyment, receiving an A+ in arithmetic.
And while he is still young enough to enjoy it.
That's true.
The peak of human enjoyment occurs around age 85.
Especially in France.
And now we must go.
Remember, your soul is an illusion.
But Jimi Hendrix will live forever.
And there they go.
The French couple.
We are not the French couple.
We are the couple from France.
Shannon Manning is producer-director of an improvisation group called Beauty, Love, and Truth. It's got some very impressive-sounding improv events upcoming at the Pit. Well, I'm very delighted to see you behind a microphone. I've only seen you improvising on a stage and everywhere else, too. Watching improvisation, listening to improvisation.
I've been doing it a while.
Addicted to improvisation. And Shannon's joined by some of her players, Chris Mills and Ed Iyades. How are you guys?
Very well, thank you.
So yes, you're all intrigued by the beauty, love, and truth of improvisational theater. Shannon, you'll have to tell, since you're just off Delathon, a Del Close Memorial at the Upright Citizens Brigade performance. You must tell us how you got to your addiction.
Well, I read your book. That was the first part that set me off on that.
I was surprised to find that out.
Yeah, I might be one of the few people that came into improv because they read the book. Usually they read your book about the compass after they've been doing improv for a while, but I read it because it was about the University of Chicago, and I thought it was something interesting, and then I've been trying to recreate that experience as much as I could since then. So I started studying at the Improv Olympic with Del, and
who Del Close is.
Del Close was a teacher. He was one of the Compass players in the very beginning of improv, and he also did a lot to sort of to make improv an art form, the long form improv, so that it exists on its own.
So it went beyond the short comedic scene. It became a kind of collective, a group experience that could be expanded and expanded on and on for, I guess, ad infinitum, but till its illogical conclusion.
Yeah, well, I think he was building on what a lot of people did before him, but I think and a lot of that came from music, a lot of that came from jazz, a lot of that came from rock and roll, just how bands are formed, how you can improvise music, how you can come in with some parts of it already done and then create from there, I don't know, I've always been attracted to both spheres of it, because, I've worked in jazz world for a while, too, and to me, it's all the same thing. It's the same sorts of, honesty, discovery, laughter, when you see someone struggling on stage, even during a jazz solo, and then they come through, and they're and then you're like, yeah.
It took me years to realize that connection, that I couldn't understand, really. Why do I like both these art forms?
Yeah.
And then I figured it out. They're both the same, really, that they really are about being in the moment, figuring it out, knowing the rules, and being able to prevail over the rules. How did you go? Were you guys also familiars of Del Close? This is Ed, by the way, Iyades,
Yeah, I became familiar with Del Close as I started to learn improv. I was always an aficionado of comedy, and a friend of mine and I moved to Chicago, and then we just started taking classes on a whim, actually because it was the summer, and Improv Olympic had air conditioning. So we started going to shows, and they had a free show.
It's not a reason to come to WBAI.
It is a reason to go see live shows all through New York.
Yeah. But so that kind of got us into it, and we really enjoyed watching it. And the thing that was intriguing, I saw a show early on when I was watching shows called Zumpf, which was Miles Stroth and Dan Bacadal. It was a two-man show, and it was very theatrical, and it wasn't based on the laughs, although it was very funny most of the time. It was my first encounter with improvisation that was based on the moment rather than the laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those moments were funny, but the thing that I love about improv is that it's about the moment that you find yourself in and discovering what's funny about it. Mm-hmm. I always say discovery rather than invention. You're not inventing a funny premise. You're putting yourself in a situation in the moment, and then you're finding and discovering what's funny about
it. With the other person.
Correct, yeah.
Which ideally it would be what life would be about, but this is a lot safer.
No, it isn't. Which is safer? Improvisation?
On stage, yeah.
On stage is safer. There is something. I think there are some people in the room that would agree with that. And are you a Chicago guy as well, Chris Mills?
I did live in Chicago for a very long time, but I've been in New York for about 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to improv really through Beauty, Love, Truth, because the basic premise of what Shannon and the performers in Beauty, Love, Truth do is that instead of taking suggestions from the audience, they have a musical guest who will play a song, and then the scenes will be inspired from the music.
Well, that's pretty interesting. So that's what you've taken from your experience of Charles Mingus. We never thought of that, but it was really a great idea.
And Sue Mingus, how she organizes things, how she keeps the big band together. I mean, the Beauty Love Truth has a rotating cast, and I think that keeps it fresh. I think it keeps it lively. You know, we're always letting people have a new experience by coming in, so we never get bogged down with, like, group dynamics and things like that that other groups suffer from. But but I definitely, through that process of always having new people, music is the one thing, like, you could have people come in and do monologues and or do poetry or do whatever. There's something about music that makes everyone take it so seriously, and they connect and they try to find the meaning in the songs for them. And so they're bringing a little bit more of them, their full selves, into the work.
So let me get a sense of this. Whereas the audience would say, as I ask for a suggestion from the audience, where are we? They would say, you're in the bathroom. That's where they would always say, but maybe they wouldn't. Maybe you'd be in the kitchen. Maybe you'd be somewhere else. And then you would put yourself spatially in the scene and then evolve the scene that way, probably through where you are. How does this work?
So we don't.
How do you know where you are?
We don't actually take any suggestions from the audience.
Right.
So it's
none.
All of our suggestions are from musicians.
And is a musician consciously suggesting anything?
No,
they
come prepared to play a couple songs, and so they play their own songs. So, like, Chris is a, you know, recording artist. You know, he's had several albums and stuff. So we have we had Georgia and Ira from Yola Tango come to be our guest. Bob Durow is coming up.
Bob Durow, that's very interesting to me because, well, we know who he is and everything.
Yeah.
And, in fact, he used to hang out with Mingus many a night at Bradley's, and he's been around a long time. And I imagine has seen a lot of improvisational theater, too. And you're going to be joined by Gary Goodrow,
Gary Goodrow is going to be doing with us.
Who is... who's worked with Bob Durow many times, but also with practically every single improvisational company since it began.
Including the committee, which was where Dell kind of solidified this long-form structure that we kind of play with still today.
Yeah, I think Dell would say explored rather than solid. I think
Did you know Dell, too?
I didn't know him personally, but I knew a lot of. I studied with a lot of people who studied with him, and I was always infected by his actual shying away from solidifying anything. You know, like he wanted to figure out how you could do this as an art form, but he was about exploring and just kind of always shaking it up whenever he thought he'd found it, kind of shaking it up again and finding what happened. So. So I was always really intrigued with that sense of we're always trying to figure something out and solidify it in our minds so we can understand, and that impulse to then shake it up again and figure it out again is very intriguing to me. I love that.
Because once you start to put limits on it, then you start to defeat what you're trying to do in the first place.
Well, you do have to have some rules. What are your guidelines? If you're going to improvise off some music, there are how many of you on the playing field there?
Well, I should mention now, for this past year, we've been running it, and I'm co-producing with Louis Perlman, who's was actually teaching this to his kids in camp, this structure. And I never really kind of approached it that it was a structure. I said, musician's going to play, we're going to do some scenes. And I said it very much like Dell would, you know, go up do this, and then we'll find some sort of maybe connection, whatever.
Yeah.
And I was very loose about it. So Louis has been running the rehearsals and kind of giving people like a safety net to kind of feel like they can explore whatever they want. So he's running a little, you know, we have one rehearsal before the show with the cast for that show, and then we do it. So our structure is basically, all we know is the musician's going to play about four songs. They might play more, they might play less. In between that, we'll do sets of scenes. So those scenes can be whatever happens within those sets is dictated.
But how do you play those scenes? What rules guide those scenes? I mean, are you characters? Do you know who your characters are? Do you find them in the scene? Do you find where you are in the scene? Do you follow any of
it? It's all discovery.
It's all discovery.
Yeah, we go in with a blank slate pretty much. Mm-hmm. I find also that becomes easier than having a few elements planned out ahead of time. I feel when you do that, most of the time I've found that it becomes harder to be in those scenes because you're focused on what you had ahead of time. When you're pure discovery, when you're purely in the moment, you're paying attention to everything, and it's much easier actually to then bounce around.
Do you
ideas.
Find your character? Do you yeah. need a character? Do you yeah. need a place where you are? Do you need a relationship? Yeah, you
most
do.
Most of the time, yeah.
And that just comes upon it comes on you.
From yeah. the moment. So,
from the moment. What was yeah. your favorite character that you played that came out of you in the middle of basking in some music? Can you remember? Say it was your
well,
music.
Well, I've only been an improviser with Beauty Love Truth once. I've mainly been a musical guest with uh-huh. them. So last week was actually my first time as an improviser, and it was great. I mean, there's you. You're
an aging stripper. You were. I was
you did play that.
Yeah. I was an aging. Yeah, I was an aging supermodel. Great. I was.
Oh, sorry, a stripper.
A clueless.
An aging.
But who ended up stripping? I think yes. in the end.
You did. Right.
It was Vegas.
And a clueless crew member on Columbus's voyage to America.
Well, yeah. How did you know it was Vegas? From what was the signal to you that it was Vegas? Did somebody play some theme song of Las Vegas? Or I mean, I'm just curious to know how people agree on
the it's not so much agreeing that specifically Vegas, but you're in a bar, your scene partner is obviously a very well-dressed kind of like smoking, scotch-drinking guy. You know, and then you enter the scene and he's meeting with you because he runs the modeling agency that you work for and you're over the hill.
Vegas is only something.
How do you know all that? Where did you?
He maybe said it just in passing, not in exposition.
He has already said it at some point in the scene. And how do you know to enter the scene?
You take a chance.
I see. I see.
Jump and the net will appear.
You jump and the net will appear. Are there any rules for entrances or exits? Do you have to have something major to bring to the stage, or can you just slump in and have it come upon you what you're doing there?
We play with such talented people that I don't think that we ever really have to set these rules down, but I remember one of the rules that Del would say was just like, only come if you're needed.
That's what
I mean. And you just felt it. Like, you don't ever come, you don't ever do this work because you have something to prove. Or
you want to be there.
The center of attention.
You want to be on stage.
This, it's not going to work for you to be the star of this kind of work.
And so someone's on stage by themselves, you come in because you're going to be the foil, and that gives them a chance to express their idea. And then you accept that idea and then start building with them in the scene.
So did you take in these scenes that you have, we talked a little bit about the long form, and people talk about this in improv circles as if everybody in the world knew what the hell we were talking about, but short scenes were the sort of standard of improvisational theater. Actually, they weren't, even before short scenes evolved, because they were manageable. Two actors, three actors could conceive come to a beginning, middle, and end in a short scene, and the lights could go out, and everybody would clap, be fine. Do 10, 15, 20 of those scenes, you'd have a show. Some of them would be memorized, some of them would be created on the spot. But even before that in the history of improvisation, there were scenario plays. They were actually plays, and it was that Del Close tried to return to without the writing down of the scenario.
Yeah.
He wanted to be able to go on with the story from the scene to the next scene, the next scene, the next scene, no matter how, right, am I right here?
Yeah.
No matter how they transformed, the group would be able to have a collective consciousness so that they could really make a play.
And it's actually, beyond that, it has evolved to even more fragmented. You need less and less context each time as an audience and players become more and more familiar. If you look at someone in one of my improv classes with Mick Napier back in Chicago, he kind of gave the example of cop shows. If you watch Dragnet or cop shows from the 50s, you would see the cops get into a car, you take the call, get into the car, drive, get out of the car, walk. Now you just can cut from the phone ringing to them appearing at the doorstep. You know, like, you've cut out a lot of context that audiences don't need anymore, and that's what's happened with improv, where you need less introduction, you need less table setting for the audience to take in what you're giving them.
And I don't think it's even that important that people, I mean, people still are surprised that it's improvised, and they still want to know, what did you work out beforehand? We did not. Half the people don't even know each other.
Well, what's the rule on that, David? That the audience is going to
always
if it's good, they're going to not believe it's improvised, and if it's bad, they'll say, "Oh, that's improvised."
So I think that we just don't, like, with most people, we don't really care whether people know it's improvised. It happens to have to be improvised to create the kind of work that we want to create.
Right.
But it's not like a parlor game anymore. It's not like, oh, look, and it's all improvised. I don't care. It was
good.
It was a good
yes.
play.
It was a good play that
had music and celebrated an artist's work.
That's a big advance. It really is a big advance. And do you find that the audience is more sophisticated, that just in general people are more comfortable with what goes on in an improvisation, that they know more? No.
I don't know. I mean, I think we were just talking about this when I have some friends, because we attract audiences that are coming to see the musicians a lot of times.
Uh-huh.
They're people that think that they might not like improv, and then they see it, and they don't really care whether it's improvised or not. They just saw something they liked that had meaning, that made them sad, that made them laugh, that made, you know, sense, and had a beginning and a middle and an end. We have a really nice way to wrap it up, you know, and so it really always has this theatrical, or almost cinematic even, feeling to it. So, I don't know how that's not sophisticated. That's, you know,
when I feel
it,
too.
It's
when,
what it is.
Yeah. When you're discovering in the moment, that's the other thing, is people can really read. We're all, audiences and improvisers alike, are all very sophisticated readers of human body language.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're all discovering, the audience can sense that, and they feel automatically, subconsciously, like a part of it. So it doesn't matter a lot of the time whether they're sophisticated improvisation audience. They get it, they see what you're doing, and they feel a part of it, and it's enjoyable if it's well
right.
done.
That's yeah. right. It is something you want to be part of, too. Well, the thing now is to go see it, right?
Yeah.
It's called Beauty, Love, Truth. That's the ultimate name for an improv company,
right now,
isn't
right?
it? And it's not even the same company twice, right?
No, it's always going to be a different cast, a different musician.
And a different musician. And the one that's upcoming at...
July
26th, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Is that 26th, that's a Thursday, and that's going to be the one with Bob Dureau and mm-hmm. Gary Goodrow. And you guys are you in or out of this particular
Ed's
one?
Ed's in it.
I'm in
Ed's
it.
Ed's in it.
I have an improv class that night.
You better learn something.
Skin his chops up.
Before you come back. And are you in it, Shannon? Are you
I am
playing?
In it. Yeah, Louis Perlman and I are in every show, and then we have a rotating cast.
Wonder, you are
and some core people, like Ed's part of the core, and you know, people come back.
And where is the pit?
The pit is at 123 East 24th Street.
How easy could that be?
Yeah.
Well, let's all get on. Let's get behind Beauty, Love, Truth, because Shannon has been an advocate of all three of those high standards for improvisation from the time I met her, and has never failed.
Yay!
You.
All because of you, Janet. Of course.
Oh boy, I'll accept that. Why not? Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Chris
Thank
Mills,
you.
Ed Iyadis, and Shannon Manning. Wow. This is Cat Radio Cafe. I'm Janet Coleman. You are
David Dozer,
the displaced improviser at this moment.
Yeah, right.
What
Severin said was when it's really good, Severin Darden said when an improvisation is really good, the audience says that wasn't improvised. And if it doesn't work out too well, they say, well, that's improvisation.
So there you go.
So that was what you were
looking for there. That's what I wanted you to say.
Well, and I just did.
All right. Well, now for some preset lines. Welcome. I'm very happy to welcome back Cheryl Ferrone and Jim Petoza, who have been founders of the Potomac Theater Group, a mission-based theater group, and the mission is, I'm going to let you say what it is, because it really resonates for us here at WBAI, but I think right now your time has really come because of the political implications of the kind of works you choose. The two plays that you've chosen to do as revivals this year are Shel Churchill's Serious Money and Monster, which is based on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, written by
Neil Bell,
and each of you is directing one.
Right.
Cheryl's doing the Carol Churchill, and Jim is doing Monster. Now, talk a little bit about the Potomac Theater's mission and how you choose plays, and how you came to create this mission for yourself. Not so easy.
Well, it's
It goes way back to our founding, which was actually in the late 80s in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And as Jim has reminded us all recently, we moved to Washington with the express purpose of being a politically oriented theater company, because at that time there was absolutely no political theater in the nation's capital, which seemed a stunning oversight.
Not even Capitol steps, or was that it?
I think we started before they
really
did.
Yeah.
We opened the door, we hope, for all kinds of companies. Mm-hmm. And that has always been wide-ranging. I mean, we the plays are not, or it feels more honest to say, socially and culturally pungent work, which allows us also to be the definers of the word political, which is pretty broad.
I also think that the work that we do, while it's widely diverse year to year based on what we think audiences need to be provoked with, we do exist as an irritant. We believe that the theater can be a pleasurable enterprise even when it is scratching your comfort zone.
Right.
And Potomac Theater Project, through all its 26 years, has always sought to disrupt and awaken and illuminate through real human stories and ideas that bring people to an aha moment of perhaps discomfort, but ultimately to action. So I do appreciate what you're saying in terms of the mission connection between what you guys do here at the radio and what we're doing
in
the theater.
We're not having placards here. We're talking about something else.
Exactly. But
still, there's an underlying recognition that work needs to be done here in terms of consciousness.
Absolutely.
Raising. Yeah. And you do, very often, you do revivals of things, that plays that have been neglected. You are probably the biggest purveyors of Howard Barker's plays.
Absolutely.
Right? You practically alone have brought back the plays of Howard Barker for audiences' reconsideration, correct? And how did you come upon that work?
Barker, I think we actually stumbled upon him in the very early 80s when Manhattan Theater Club did what I think was their only engagement with his work, a production of No One to Blame. And he was a playwright whose voice immediately intrigued us. And in fact, No One to Blame was the first show we did in Washington in 1987. It was part of the first season, and part of the first season here in New York in 2007. He's a very prolific writer, and he's actually more popular on the continent in Germany and in France even than in his own country. But since we've started to do his work and to do it regularly, this is the first year of the six we've been in New York that there's not a Barker piece in the repertory. We have seen a number of other theater companies starting to do him.
Yeah.
And in fact, in sort of a long-delayed major theater debut in the UK, his play Scenes from an Execution, which we did here in 2008, is being done at the Royal National Theatre in London in the fall, and they have neglected his work for years. So,
so you've been doing a lot of dig work for
we think so,
for the world of theatre. Now, because this is almost uncanny that you chose Serious Money, Carol Churchill's play about corruption in the London Stock Exchange, or the something similar to the LIBOR. It's got similar. It's about true greed, corruption, destruction on the part of the financial rulers. And here we are. Could you have picked a better week for it, even, to open?
No, I mean, sadly, in a certain way, no. We couldn't have. And it's funny because the play is a joy to work on. It's done primarily in rhyming couplets.
That's amazing.
So that's fascinating. It's got a cast of 16. That there's a lot of onstage energy, and it has music, and it has dance. So it's got lots and lots of theatrical elements. But you make the assumption that because she wrote it in the 80s, about the 80s, that, well, it may be a bit of a period piece, until you actually start to read it and actually start to see both the correlations with what's going on now and also the seedbed of all of this greed and all of this entitlement and all of these sets of assumptions about how who should have power and who should be able to keep power from others. And even at that time, yes, it's focused primarily around the London International Financial Futures Exchange. But she has a number of American characters, and Ivan Bosky is one of her primary references, I think probably because he was so
he was the monster
well-known.
Du jour.
And which is a lovely segue into monster. Because we were talking
about I do want to know what the connection is, because these plays are alternating in repertory, and this is Monster, a variant of the Mary Shelley story, the Frankenstein story. So, how is this one presented, and how is it refreshed for modern life?
Neil Bell is a contemporary writer who spends half of his time writing original plays and half of his time adapting. Always looks at the stories that he chooses to adapt from a contemporary sensibility. And I know in conversation with him, he does view Monster as a deeply political play in the sense that, and he's writing as an American, we are responsible for that which we create. And the story of American power globally has a lot to do with the creation of entities, whether they are individuals of power or factions of power, that we choose to create because in the moment they seem expedient to a national cause for survival, we then tend to distance ourselves from them and abandon them in certain moments, and invariably, history tells us, they come back to get us.
Right.
And what Mary Shelley's dealing with is, in very large terms and in very personal terms, the singular journey of this one man's desperate attempt to, as one of the characters puts it, cure death, a seemingly desirable outcome. But then upon creating life is so frightened by what he has created, he seeks to distance himself from it, and there is no distance. The play deals with what Cheryl and I have often talked about as the essential hubris that exists in both the financial, the Thatcherite world of 80s London, which is just for us. A stand-in for the Reagan era of the same time and the same things, and the hubris in this more kind of classic romantic tragedy, really, that is at the heart of Frankenstein. And these two plays talk to each other extremely well.
And have you been talking to each other during the direction of these two productions? So that are you watching each other and so forth?
We certainly are now. And before we started, we knew each other's work because that's been a hallmark of the company. Every director obviously needs to choose work that excites him or her because that's the only way you're going to do authentic and interesting and layered work. But on the other hand, it's creating meshing the pieces together in the way that we can present them to audiences so that they can, that it enriches each or all three, if it's a three-play season. It enriches all those pieces to see them juxtaposed.
As a group. Well, let's tell people how they can get hold of this, because we're coming to an end here. And should we give them these initials here? PTG/NY?
It's PTP.
PTP.
PTP slash NYC.
Potomac Theater, what does that stand for?
It stands for Potomac Theater Project. /New York City.
NYC.
PTC/NYC.org.
You can find out which plays are running which days, because they're running in repertory. But I think we all should see them. I think I've seen your work before. Cannot wait to see Serious Money, which opens tonight?
Monster
tomorrow
opens tonight.
Monster
Serious
tonight?
Money tomorrow night.
Here's to you.
Thank you so much, Janet.
Onward and upward.
PTP.org. PTPNYC.org.
Okay, you got it. And this has been Cat Radio Cafe. We've been broadcasting from the chilly studios of WBAI in New York. Everybody mop yourself off. I'm Janet Coleman. You are?
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. Okay. You going to run in there now to the other office?
Yes, I have to go to the other office now and
wrap yourself in.
Keep changing the temperature up and down. I think it's good for you. Somehow. It's dramatic. It's a personal theater where I keep raising and lowering the curtain on myself, made out of some strange little pet blanket.
not a bad idea, isn't it?
One person theater.
Oh, temperature theater.
If I close my eyes, there's no audience.
You know, this temperature theater, I like it. Cold or hot theater.
Cold and hot theater, yeah.
Or cold and hot improv. Turn the weather up, turn the weather down.
Oh, yeah. There's a suggestion for you.
Oh, boy, let's make it our next company. Lettuce, tomato, and bacon sandwich. We won't see you next week, I don't think. We'll be in Fun Drive, but we will see you the following Monday. So please contribute to WBAI and keep us hopping along here. Thank you so much. Stay tuned.
Hi there, it's your in-studio wake-up call team. I'm Ife Dancy.
And I'm Esther Ama.
It's that time again.
You mean summertime?
No, I mean WBAI drive time.
Yes, it is. We've got great ideas, other WBAI producers. We've got...
I know what we've got, but what we really need, though, are volunteers.
Yes, we do, especially in those early morning hours.
6:30 a.m. to 10 a.m., we need you to come on down and answer phones. Yes, WBAI is our family, so we need all our family members to make it successful.
Wow, are we going to sing Sister Sledge?
No. We're going to pitch, bring you great premiums, and talk hot topics.
So come on down. July 10th is when we start. Wake Up Call really needs you. Call 212-209-2800 after 9:30 a.m. so we can put your name in the system, or email volunteers@wbai.org.
I'm Ife Dancy.
I'm Esther Ama.
We approve this message.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is a place to turn to. Peace.
Oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Yeah, my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. And yeah, my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my. My God. Oh my God.
Hi, my name is Somi. I'm a singer from Uganda and Rwanda. When I'm in New York, I like to listen to WBAI 99.5 FM. Habari, mimi naitwa Somi, mwimbaji wa Uganda na Rwanda. Kama nipo New York, napenda kusikiliza WBAI 99.5 FM. Thank you.